Right, folks, welcome to yet another episode of Let's Talk Common Sense with me, Mike Omni. It's a great one. I know we didn't have an episode last week. I feel like one of those YouTubers. I'm going to be consistent now. But we are trying to be consistent. And I guess my thing is, rather than bringing lots of people on, my thing is value, right? So let's bring on value. And that way, it might mean that we skip a week, as it were. But we've got a really interesting episode today. I'm really excited about talking to this person because I was telling them off air, I've stalked them for the last 24 hours listening to a lot of content. So we're going to get into a great conversation, especially if coming out of lockdown, you're thinking, you know what, I need to change careers or I need to change my life a bit, right? I need to kind of maybe what lockdown did was what it did for a lot of people, which is make them realize that perhaps I'm doing the wrong thing and I need to try something else out and try being different. So we're going to talk all about kind of productivity, personal development, mindfulness. These are all words that I think we're going to touch on today, or things or themes we're going to touch on. So it's looking like it's going to be a great episode. Of course, if you're interested in finding out what's happening in the world, you can head over to tcsnetwork.co.uk. All sorts of articles there, not least about Dominic Cummins. Dead cat. I hear someone screaming. It's still interesting to talk about. So you can head over there to find out all about that. Coinbase, lots of other things that's happening. Head over to tcsnetwork.co.uk. But I'm going to introduce our guest today, who's Chris Williamson, who's the host of the Modern Wisdom podcast. Chris, I confessed earlier that I've been binging your stuff, but your stuff is so bingeable. How do you, I mean, it looks like so much detail goes into the content you put out. How did you get into this world? I mean, you just know what you're doing.
Flattery will get you everywhere, man. Honestly, just keep on. I need you as like a hype man before I do every podcast. You can just gas me up before I'm about to go on. I don't know. I just do my thing, and it seems to be working well. And Rogan said, I once heard Rogan say something where he was like, I don't really know what I'm doing, man, but I know that it's working and I'm terrified of breaking it. So that's kind of where I'm at. Whatever we've got going on seems to work. So I'm trying not to break.
you're doing really well. I should say as well, you know, this is Let's Talk Common Sense. So at some stage we will disagree probably. So this is the calm before the storm, perhaps. And what we try and do here is, you know, really talk about issues, problems, and bring in kind of polarities, different perspectives together. I've watched a lot of your interviews, as I said, over the past 12 hours. And they're brilliant, right? Because I think you create such a interesting atmosphere for guests that are typically, you know, very political and very kind of, you know, hard hitting. They can come here and just speak, here I go, wisdom, you know, without that fear of it's going to be boxing, so to speak. I wanted to just start off with your journey because it's really interesting to me. I said at the start that for folks who are coming out of lockdown and are kind of like, I want to do something different, or I want to kind of, you know, I want to try something new, or I want to move away from, you know, the industry. I'm going to move somewhere else. I think you can speak to that because you've navigated a couple of industries, haven't you?
Yes, I've bounced between a couple of different pathways in life. I mean, if anyone's thinking of going on Love Island, I could probably give them some advice about how to do that. I could give them advice about how to get on Take Me Out. If you've considered becoming a club promoter or a DJ or a commercial model, or a wasteman student for 5 years. All of these, I've got reams of experience. All of these I can bring in. But yeah, I guess my story is very classic working class upbringing, northeast of the UK. Went to university, first person in my family to go uni. Went to uni, started a business the day that I got there because I'd spent all my money on booze in Freshers Week. Sat down next to this guy in my first ever seminar and said, I've spent all my money. He said, oh, I can get you a flyering job with this company I work for. That guy that I sat next to in my first ever seminar is my business partner still today, 14 Love years it. Later. We still haven't got rid of each other. I was groomsman at his wedding. He's got two kids and dogs and wife and all this sort of stuff, which is awesome, right? So then roll it forward a little bit. I become a club promoter. I go on Take Me Out. I do Love Island. I get Blue Tick. I get free charcoal toothpaste. You do the PAs in the nightclubs with the thing. And then it got to a stage where I was like, I'm like, late 20s, is this really all that there is for me? Is this, you know, going out and partying with the boys on a weekend and getting the best Instagram story you can? Like, is that really the height of what sort of I was put on this earth to do? And I had like a non-scary existential crisis, like one of those ones where you just think, like, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing with my life? How am I spending my time? Is this really what I should be doing? And over a good period of self-reflection, I worked out that that wasn't necessarily correct. I still run my events. I still own the events business, but I do it from a different angle now. I'm much more interested in trying to make people better versions of themselves. The guys and girls that work for me, I really want to, you know, craft them into these little monsters that go out and take over the world. And that's what they're doing. And as a part of that, started my show, podcast, and we're now 315 episodes in, 100 New York Times bestselling authors, 15 million plays, blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
And that brings me right up to this moment now, talking to you, Mike.
That's something. Damn. I'm just thinking of something you said in, you know, you said it in a sentence or so, but I'll probe into a bit more. You know, when you have that moment and you say, this isn't for me anymore, I kind of think about listeners who may be listening and are thinking, hey, I had that a couple of times during lockdown where I'm like, you know what? The way I'm working now isn't sustainable. This can't be all there is. What does it take to go from there? You know, because I love when I meet folks who are kind of like, you know, recently watched the film called, what's it called now? It's by Pixar. I forgot what it's called. It's the one where there's a jazz musician or something.
I've seen it advertised, but yes. Yeah, I want to watch it. It looks awesome.
It's really good. There's a little concept they speak about where, you know, where a musician is in the zone, and they call it, I forgot the name, but call it. But when you meet people in the zone playing and everything seems to be kind of working together, of course there's difficulties, but for the most part, there seems to be this kind of, you know, things are working together. I'm always curious to find out how they got there. So when you had that existential crisis, as it were, did you think, yeah, I'll just go through, do podcasting, or I'll start making, you know, I'll start doing shows or events, whatever, and everything's just going to work out? Or you know, how difficult was that process of getting into actual action and stuff?
It's a good question. A lot of people, I think, ask about that inflection point because it's the beginning of the journey, right? It's the thing, it's the immediate inertia, right? The momentum that people need to get past, the wall that they need to get over in order to start themselves on a path that feels like they're finally going towards the thing that they want it to be. So I get the question. I think a lot of people that find success in these situations suffer from what's called survivorship bias, which you may be familiar with. I'm going to guess you'll be familiar with.
Maybe, yeah. But I'll let you explain it.
Okay, so the best way to explain it is they were analyzing the planes that came back from one of the world wars, let's say World War One or World War Two. They were analyzing where these planes had bullet holes in them, and they saw that the bullet holes were all along the edges of the wing and all along the back of the tail and stuff like that. And they were like, right, okay, that's where the planes are taking fire, so we'll reinforce those areas. What they didn't realize is that those are the planes that made it back. The planes that were shot down had been shot in the engine and the fuel tank and in the cockpit. So my point is that when you look at people that make it through these sort of situations, a lot of the time they turn around and they post hoc rationalize how they got to where they are because they've got this survivorship bias. You inevitably see the Elon Musks, but you don't see the 100,000 people that tried to start electric car manufacturing companies and also go to Mars at the same time who didn't make it to be Elon Musk.
Yeah.
The first thing that people need to get rid of is the myth that people who've managed to get into any place that looks like they've got it sorted out had any idea what they were doing when they began that journey. I had no idea where I was going. I decided to start doing a podcast because I enjoyed the therapeutic mode of speaking to people through a microphone. Yeah. It felt like mental therapy to me. It made me feel like I'd had a workout, like a mental workout, like I'd flossed my brain or something. So I just did that and I just kept on going. And I think this is in a world where you've got a productivity planner and a life goal and what do you want your obituary to be and what do you want your business to be in 50 years time and stuff like that. People can be scared of failing. So rather than trying to do something and potentially fail, they'll inoculate themselves from public failure by certifying private failure. And that certified private failure occurs basically by just not ever testing things. I think everybody would benefit from learning that failure is actually quite a good thing, and that having an aversion to it, it's like, look, I've tried, this thing didn't work. Okay, but you've learned a ton. Think about how many things you learn on the way to failing at something. So I can tell you all of these different things, but I've spent 20 or 30 grand on failed businesses over the last few years, a sportswear company that didn't get off the ground, and this company that didn't get off the ground, and that company, all just things that I did, that I tried, and I learned stuff from. So yes, that inflection point, a good question to ask yourself if you don't know what you want to do is, what would have had to have happened by the end of this year, by the end of 2021, in order for you to look back on 2021 and consider it a success?
Oh gosh, there's a lot to unpack there. Right? That's amazingly said. I write a mailing list every week, and I wrote today, it's Monday, about failure. Oh, I wrote yesterday about failure, and I speak about this idea that if you live a life where there isn't a threat of failure, then it's a life so cautious that you've essentially failed by default, isn't it? Like you just haven't gone out there and you haven't taken the shot. And so someone might say back to me, because I speak to people about this personally all the time, you know, especially in the world where, you know, I finished my master's degree. And I thought, you know what, let me try to start a news network, which obviously people are like, why would you do that? I mean, there's no money in news. In fact, every few months or so, we read about another fallen soldier, another news network that's closed down because, quite frankly, the ad credits aren't the same, ad revenues aren't coming in the same. And so people kind of go, mate, you picked a dying industry. You're trying to innovate where there's no money, and you know you'll start failing. So the journey to even where we are now, and it's nowhere crazy, right? It's just a journey of failure after failure, quite frankly. And you know, ergo, lots of different quotes about success and failure and stuff like that. But what I'm interested in is, some people do tell me, even when I tell them go for it, you know, you never know what you'll create. Oh, well, Mike, I don't have a safety blanket. You know, I can't afford to fail. I speak to a lot of people who are in that kind of community and that kind of mindset where they go, I don't have, you know, a rich uncle or a nice, you know, auntie that can go, all right, you know, here's 20K. It's me and my mom and dad are working jobs that aren't, you know, whatever. So I speak to a lot of students who graduate and go, I have to get a job I hate in banking because I literally have to look after my parents. Because you know they're working jobs that unfortunately that you know they're not well off at all, so that luxury, if you like, of being able to kind of you know dream big and going for it, they might say, well, I can't really do that. What would you say to them, knowing that you might not be able to kind of you know fully help them? But what would you say to someone like that?
First, I would offer them sympathy. That's a tough position to be in. You know, like that's a hard thing to do. If you are supporting your family, if you are a young person that's also contributing as a breadwinner to your family, first off, give yourself a pat on the back. That's a serious accomplishment. You know, that's a big burden. That's a heavy weight that you're shouldering. So don't take it lightly, you know, like, well done. Congratulations. That's a really good thing that you're doing. But you have time. If you have time for hobbies, you have time for a side hustle. And if you want to actually make that hustle, if you want to make FU money in the end, that side hustle needs to grow and grow and grow. If you have time to watch an hour of TikTok a day or an hour of YouTube a day, you have time to do whatever that little sliver of an evening could be to learn to whatever it might be, learn to write, build a newsletter, start writing online courses, become good at copywriting, become whatever your thing is. And a lot of the time, it doesn't even need to be something that is immediately monetizable. I did nearly 200 episodes of the podcast before I made a penny from it. So me and my video guy takes half of everything that we make on YouTube from the ad revenue. And it took, I think it took like 18 months for us to make £100. And then this last month, he made more than double what he makes from his full-time job from his share of what we made on YouTube. So the point is that the returns are going to be like this. They're going to be a hockey stick, and it's going to be stupid, 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 stupid. Oh, this is okay. It's going to feel so dumb for so long. But when you encounter that resistance, the boredom, the repetition, that's what everyone else is feeling in the same industry as you. If you're trying to be an online PT, if you're trying to coach kids to do football and come up with some sort of awesome masterclass thing, or if you're trying to do art, or if you're whatever it is, every single person in your industry is suffering with that and thinking that there is not difficulty for everyone else, even if they don't post about it online, even if you don't see them complaining about the late night grind and the boring admin and the invoices and the endless emails and back and forth and the rejection. Of course, they're not posting about that. And you can very safely assume that they're suffering with it as well, because you're suffering with it and you're not posting about it either. Obviously, yeah. You're not. You just suffer this internal torment. And so are they. So hold out. Just keep on working. Keep on going. Don't slow down. Just keep on doing your thing. Stick to whatever it is. I mean, it's trite to say if you can find something that you love to do, you'll outwork everyone else in the room, because what to you feels like play will to them feel like work. That's yeah. why I can put out 3 podcast episodes a week, because I don't want to do anything else. If I do 1 or 2 a week, I get itchy feet. I'm like, I need to have more conversations. So to the person for whom 3 a week would feel like tearing their hair out, I have a competitive advantage because I've aligned what I love to do with what I can be paid to do.
Yeah.
Also happens to be something that apparently society needs for whatever quirk in this version of the simulation has occurred where I can call this a job. Like that's also happened. But like, think people who played rugby for, you know, 10 years up until they were left university, maybe something like that. And they've got all of this amazing latent rugby info and coaching knowledge in the back of their head. You know, have you ever considered starting an academy for kids in a rich area? Because you would absolutely crush it, especially if you've got all of these credentials. Well, I was on England Academy's books and I played for Newcastle Falcons and I did this and this and this. And you think, okay, like how easily could you start that? Could you do it once a week on a school night? Could you get your shifts moved around so that you could just do it once and do it for free, or do it for £5 a session per child, or whatever it might be? Of course you could. Okay. And there we go from there. The most difficult thing to do is to get past that first bit of inertia. And I know it feels hard, but just doing something, jumping and learning to fly on the way down is the best way to do it. You learn by failing and you fail by doing.
Love this so much. And of course, we are by far in probably the most privileged position to do some of these things in history. This is something, you know, the I have to be reminded of when I start complaining inevitably, when I go, I'm not where I need to be, or things aren't going as fast as I would like them to go. Like, well, my God, you have a lot to learn for yourself. And rather than complain about what you don't have, use what you got, even if, you know, you're not too happy with everything. I think one thing you said recently in a TED talk that you did not too long ago, was it odd, number one, doing it? Was there a live audience? It felt like one of those COVID secure TED talks, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was in a full studio with an audiovisual team, but no audience, which is really bizarre.
Really odd. I did one a few years ago, and I think when I watched yours, that's what I wanted mine to be. that's what I had in mind. But mine was some random rambling about echo chambers or something. But you spoke at length in great detail about embracing your weirdness. Something that's often said in a kind of, you know, quirky way, like, oh, you're individual, go for it. But you actually spoke about what that means and how someone can actually navigate the world, right? Seeing their uniqueness, their idiosyncrasies as almost a superpower of sorts. Speak to that, man, because I found that so powerful, by the way. Thank you for doing that, for putting that out. Things so like 20,000 people have, you know, or views, and I think a lot more people should see it. But if you could distill what's going through your mind at the time, you know, to this kind of conversation, no, what would you say about that?
Yeah, it was something that is quite personal to me. I was a very unpopular kid in school, so I was always on the outside looking in, and I think I always saw being an outsider, also an only child, I always saw that as a weakness. And inevitably, you know, like the kid that got bullied in school would grow up to be some MMA fighter. I guess kind of that was similar for me. I wanted to work out what was going on, right? So, yes, the way that you need to look at any uniqueness that you have is that it is a particular competitive advantage. So if you look to the way that the world of work moves forward, people think that I need to appeal to the widest possible group. So I need to round off the edges of my personality and I curb my quirks until I erode all of the unique things about me away so that no one kind of really actually looks at me and I'm kind of just kind of like everybody else. But if you look at anybody that's been particularly successful, they're not trying to do what everybody else is doing. By doing what everyone else does, you guarantee average results. Like, that's literally what you're aiming for. You're aiming to regress to the mean of what everybody else does. What's a much more effective strategy is, okay, what do only you know? What have only you got that you can offer the world? Because nobody else has that. You can escape competition through authenticity because no one can beat you at being you.
That's good.
So there's the first one, that's competition. Secondly, socially, most people think we grow up in school, if you don't want to be different, because if you're different, you get bullied or you get ostracized or you're lonely. And that was, bloody hell, if that wasn't me. But then when you think about relationships and stuff like that, you think, like, has anybody ever fallen in love with someone because they're just so similar to everyone else? Like, what I adore about them is how they're somewhere in between this sort of vanilla and beige color. They're just so predictable, and I know everything that's going to come out of their mouth. Like, no, of course not. We love people for their idiosyncrasies. We love them for their quirks. And that's what makes a good friend as well. Like, your weakness in school of being overly sensitive means that you genuinely understand your friend's emotions, even if they don't understand them themselves. Or the fact that I didn't have the local accent where I went. I was at school in Stockton-on-Tees, northeast of the UK, very broad Middlesbrough accent. And that sucked because it immediately made me stand out. But 20 years later, it means I can do a podcast with Jordan Peterson and he can understand the words that are coming out of my mouth, as opposed to if I was some Geordie telling him why I mate, and he wouldn't be able to hear or understand a thing, right? And then the third one, and I think the most important element of this sort of weirdness paradox, is the spiritual side. And this was something that I guess was came out of that existential crisis, that if you spend your days playing a role and hiding who you truly are, you'll end up at a place in life not only that you don't want to be, but that you didn't even mean to get to. And if you play a role for so long, you never actually connect with any of the achievements that you have in life, because people aren't in love with you and what you do. They're just applauding this role you play. You're always one level removed from the things that you're doing. It's like, well, public Chris is doing this thing, so well done, public Chris, all of that adoration and love that he got. But it never actually hits home. It never actually sinks into who you are. And when you sort of wrap all of this together, what you realize is that if we want the most flourishing, beautiful, actualized civilization that we can get, there is an imperative, there is a necessity for every single person to embrace their uniqueness, their weirdness, their idiosyncrasies. They have to. Because if Dali hadn't painted his work and embraced his weirdness, he was this crazy guy, he got a mad mustache, he had all of these views, he thought he was the reincarnation of his dead brother that died 9 months before him. He was like this insanely unique fella. Michelangelo didn't do Dali, and Da Vinci didn't do Dali. So if Dali hadn't embraced everything that he was, the world would have never received his work.
Yeah.
So the imperative to every single person is, it is your duty to do what only you can because only you can. And if you don't paint your Dali, no one else is going to. So when you think about that, you think, oh, well, hang on. So you're telling me that it's a competitive advantage for me to be unique, and that socially, yeah, not everyone may like me, but some people will love me. Also, that sounds pretty good. We don't need the most amount of friends. We need the deepest number of friends, the deepest connections with friends. And then spiritually, you're telling me that I will feel greater connection to the things that I do and the people around me, and it will benefit the entire world and the human race at large. Like, that's a pretty compelling argument as far as I could see. And I managed to fit that into 15 minutes and 30 seconds or so on a TEDx stage.
No, it was well done. It was really well done. And you're speaking so much real stuff. you know, as someone who is, I'm obsessed and have been with public speaking for years, you know, just on the kind of technical level, really, and you know, well, still go through the kind of speaking stuff. But on content is where it shines, because what you are saying, Chris, is, I mean, it's genuinely life changing stuff, isn't it? And what a canvas, right? You know, last year, death, decay, lots of kind of people going through these existential crises. And so what you're saying is that thing that it's the wisdom your mum kind of gives you, right? That you cherish and you go, this is so true.
Just be yourself. Just be yourself. Yeah. Your parents are always right, man. Honestly, all of the wisdom that you come back around to, you realize that your parents and your grandparents told you when you were about five.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. And I came into a similar crisis of sort when I thought to myself, you know, it's that old phrase, you know, failure isn't the issue, you know, succeeding at something that doesn't matter or that you don't really want to see that. It's probably a bigger issue. Then you're a prisoner, as you said, this kind of weird double life almost where, you know, you don't feel like the person who people are clapping for. And I came across a quote or a phrase, and I don't know if I read it or I imagined it, whatever it is, but essentially what it was, looked at my life, looked at what I'm doing, all the kind of different things I'm doing. And I asked myself, Mike, do your choices reflect your hopes or do they reflect your fears? Because if you're living a life where the choices you make reflect your fears, then you can build a very good life. But that's only a shell of the type of life you ought to be living, because your lives aren't your choices aren't tracking your hopes. They're tracking your fears. And it's even doubly sad when folks then congratulate you for building a life that's built around your fears.
Well, that's like, the persona, man. That's you doing the persona, because they don't know that you're not actually doing what inner Mike wants. They don't know that you're playing the role of Mike squared or Mike cubed or whatever. They don't know that. There's Stephen Pressfield has this concept. It's amazing. He calls it shadow careers. And he talks about people who are too scared to do the main career that their actual passion was. A lot of the time they take up a career that's kind of similar to it, but just a bit analogous. So many football agents are failed footballers who didn't have the courage to go for being a footballer. He cites so many actors agents who are failing directors. They wanted to be in film production, but they didn't want to go for the main thing, so they do a thing that's kind of similar, but it's not quite there. And the problem is, no one will ever know except you. No one will ever know that you didn't live the life that you could have lived. And they say that true hell is when the person that you are meets the person you could have been, and that is what will lead to it, step by step, cut by cut, chip by chip, day by day, minute by minute. Each of those decisions that you make will take you further and further away from the life that you should have leaded. And there's, I suggested to Jordan Peterson when I had him on the show, a rule that he didn't put into his original 42, which is part of his work, that I said that he should have added in. And it's the most powerful one of all, I think. And it's, don't practice what you do not want to become. And that means that the end goals that you get are contributed to by each of your individual daily actions. And if you are the person that today watches Netflix on the nighttime all night, and tomorrow watches Netflix and has a bag of Doritos, and the day after has a bag of Doritos and a can of Coke, and you just, each time that you make that decision, it pushes you further and further down that way. And if that's the life that you want, then great. But a lot of the time, people don't step back and actually ask the question, where do I want to go?
No, I mean, you bring up, this is heavy stuff, by the way, folks. Folks, you are listening. I'm sure you're like, I'm only going to work.
Yeah, if this was the middle of a gym session, give us another 5 or 10 minutes, and me and Mike can find something to complain about with each other. We'll argue, and we'll get you amped up for your first set. They might be on the way to the gym. They're crying in the car, but they're on the way to the gym.
I'm just thinking of someone on the way to work, just going,
what am I doing with my life?
But you know, you brought up the Jordan Peterson interview, which I loved, by the way. So
thank you.
It's interesting because, again, I said at the start that I think one thing that's so interesting about watching your show is that, again, these typically political figures, I think sometimes, not that you only get political figures, but folks who are polemics, you know, they get involved in discussion and discourse, they step into this what appears to be almost a safe space where they can just talk about an issue without feeling the need to kind of, you know, pontificate and stuff like that. And it's interesting that, that this uniqueness and weirdness you speak about, oddly enough, it's one of the things I was studying when I was in university. And it's one of the reasons I love Jordan Peterson. I've never said this publicly. I'm always kind of like a quiet lover of Jordan Peterson, kind of reading this stuff and trailing through everything.
Is that a strategic thing?
It's odd because it's kind of like I try not to profess love for anyone online just because of, unfortunately, it's because of what I'm about to say is online is so tribal that for me, it almost seems more performative than it is genuine and authentic. And I mean that to say that I do not believe, and listen, I've been involved in politics since I was 13 years old, but I do not believe anybody is really left wing or right wing. As someone who studied politics, philosophy, economics, started a master's in political theory, started a PhD in philosophy, I just don't buy this left wing, right wing continuum that people are so hooked on, because the truth is we're also, and again, I've spoken to so many different people about this, we're also complex. That the idea that we could find one wing or one group that perfectly encompasses what we believe, and we have to stay there, and we cannot switch or cannot appreciate something from it just strikes me as ridiculous. And the more I watch political commentators, the more I'm like, bruv, all these conversations we're having in left wing and the right wing and the woke culture, it's just not doing anything other than making us feel, you know, ideologically obtuse, you know, like we've got an answer to things. And what I love about Jordan Peterson the most is wonderful thinker, great intellect, all these amazing things. However, his ability to kind of say, I don't know, and not be a cookie cutter version of, you know, wisdom is something that I just rate so highly. Like I've seen him publicly go, I don't get it.
Think about what that tells you. Somebody saying, I don't know, and somebody saying something which doesn't allow you to fit them into a box, it's essentially a costly, hard to fake signal of authenticity.
Yeah.
Because the likelihood of him coming to that incredibly nuanced and very different, non-typical viewpoint through lazy thought is almost zero.
Yeah.
Whereas, how many people do you see on TV where you get to hear the first three sentences out of their mouth and you can predict the remainder of the segment that they're going to say? That means that you're not a serious thinker. If I know one of your views and from that I can extrapolate out all of the other views that you've got, you're not a serious thinker. Either that, or you happen to be the guy or girl that sits directly in the middle of the mean of the distribution. Do you know what I mean? You are the fattest bit of that bell curve there, and you're just the one person that splits the middle. Like, but that's not the way it works. Yeah. And yeah, man, I think I agree. I think people who are prepared to say I don't know and not feel like it undermines their opinion or their stance or their reputability, it's a very encouraging signal, and I think everyone should do it a lot more.
Where do you think we're going, though? Because this is where I want to press into now. Because as I think about the future of, you know, political discussion, especially online and political thought, part of me feels like we've peaked. Because it's just downhill from here, I think. Because literally, you've got, and I have lots of right-wing friends, I have lots of left-wing friends. And they routinely talk about each other, very seldom to each other, because each think that the other isn't an honest actor. And I kind of go, well, how are we going to solve some of the biggest problems in the world if we're literally split on two different sides? And this is not me being a hippie, like, we all just get along. I get the actual differences between political wings. Something I researched extensively. I get it. But the part of me just feels like things are becoming more shallow. People are becoming, I just keep hearing the same lines from the same people all the time. And I guess from when I think about kind of where you sit, when you look at all of this, what do you think's coming up? Like, if you were to put your prophetic hat on for a minute, like, what's next, man?
I've asked some of the smartest people on the planet this question. Douglas Murray, Andrew Doyle, Jordan, Sargon, Michael Malice, Gad Saad. Like, I've asked tons of people, and they don't know. But I think there's only really sort of one of two ways that I can see it going. The first one is that you get increasing levels of extremism, which is not good. This is the one that we really, really, really don't want to have happen. Yeah. The problem you have is that for all that the mainstream media say that it is an increase in far-right fascist hate groups, and they're just not taking to the streets, at least not in numbers. So the point is that they're not mobilized right now. The thing that people who are well-meaning liberals and people on the left need to be very concerned about is letting the most extreme members of their group get away with things that they don't agree with, which will galvanize the people at the opposite end of that spectrum. Because if the people at the far, far, far right decide to get going, they're the ones with the guns. They're the ones that have got the history in military service. They are the ones that you need to be really, really concerned about. And if you get this whiplash effect where the left is pushed so hard, and basically, you know, say it how it is, the left adopted the tactics of the right. They adopted these very militaristic, the black bloc, you know, the overly aggressive, like that used to be what was associated with the far right, but that's now been, that's one way that it goes. I really hope that that doesn't happen. What I think is more likely is that these increasingly shallow narratives just dissolve themselves away. If you were to talk about the identity politics and sort of the critical theory that the left appears to be using at the moment, it's inherently self-contradictory, because when you start to slice and dice society by increasing these small and small margins, each in-group then gets split into another in and out group. If you've got white women, then you've got white women that are also straight and white women that are gay. And then you've got white women that are gay and white women that are gay and able-bodied and then disabled-bodied. And you continue to fracture society down until everyone becomes back to being an individual again. And inherently, it's so self-contradictory that I think that can't go on. I also think that some of the arguments that you get from the right, and you sort of alluded to this earlier on, are so performative. They're so... because it's easy to do woke bashing, right? Like, look at the ridiculous contradictoriness of the left. But it's like, there's only so many times that you can have a, like, Ben Shapiro destroys SJW, like, compilation thing before you go, well, dude, this is just the same thing over and over again. Like, yes, it's silly, but I think everything will become stress tested by reality. And when some sort of serious issue occurs, you need people to get their shit in order. Get themselves together, you know, and start moving. That being said, we didn't really bring ourselves together as a homogenous group during the biggest pandemic of the last 100 years. So maybe that's me being overly hopeful, because if we didn't do it up against a potential world-ending virus, then, like, what's it going to be? We're going to need to get Will Smith and the aliens out again.
It did happen for a bit, though, Chris. Like, I think for the first few months of the pandemic, though, I think there was some solidarity, but I think it was because no one knew what was going on. So we were almost stunned into solidarity, you know, because we were all kind of going, what's happening?
That's a cool way to put it. Stunned into solidarity. I like
and
that.
Then, and then the minute we kind of understood what was going on, we're like, oh, yes, I hate you.
I forgot. I don't like you. Yeah.
You know, on this point of authenticity, which is something that, you know, I'm so fascinated by, especially when I look at these figures, and I almost have a chart in my head, and I'm probably not the best assessor of it, of, you know, people I enjoy listening to speak, especially, you know, on an intellectual level. Intellectual honesty for me is the most important thing. It, just to have someone who can be honest enough to go, not even, I don't know, but whose thoughts are messy enough for me to believe it's real. And they aren't just kind of like, you know, everything aligns. And you go, yeah, but you're probably, you know, being paid to say something. However, part of me wonders, you know, what your advice would be for people out there who, I guess some of the listeners may go, this is getting too specific, but I'm really interested in finding out your thoughts on it, because I find that most people, if we just think about political commentators or young people, whatever it is, they start out with this genuine kind of intellectual pursuit of what is right, what is wrong, so on and so forth, and folks are trying to make sense of the world. In fact, some people do that for the rest of their lives, trying to make sense of the world. However, there comes a point where maybe the money you make gets linked to some sort of ideology, as it were, or just the way the online sphere is created, or sorry, it's currently constituted, say Twitter, to stand out, you just have to say, you have to just pick a side and just kind of be a troll or say something crazy. So I've been speaking a couple of episodes now about the advent of like online folks who kind of I hate to do this because he's changed now, but you know, folks who kind of do like a Milo Yiannopoulos kind of thing and kind of be a provocateur for a while and then later pivot and then become a bit more sensible. And young people increasingly, you know, so for instance, there's a lot of young people I know who openly are like, I'm a communist. And they go at communism, we need communism. And they don't really believe it. But it's like, this stuff is going to, you know, get attention. This stuff's going to boost my following. And then later on, I can pivot, you know, become a bit more sensible, start working on the BBC a bit more. And like, everyone's going to forget what used to happen. And unfortunately, they give up that authenticity, that purity of pursuit, if you like, they had at the start, is gone, quite frankly. Mm. How do you advise people navigating, you know, the fourth industrial revolution, as it were, and the kind of the pressures, I guess, that exist to placate and to capitulate and do these different things?
It's a really good question, man. If you can get essentially effort-free clout and fame and reputation, it's a really difficult thing to say no to. I mean, you're talking to a guy that went on Love Island, you know? Like, the only difference between me and the person that's screaming that they're a communist and smashing in the front windows of Santander, the only difference is that I was doing it at a much shallower level of intellectual sort of curiosity. The Extinction Rebellion people are busy breaking windows, and I was talking about Omar and that bird that he mugged off last night, bruv. Like, that was what I was on. So I understand from a first-hand advantage, like, I understand why it's so alluring, right, to be able to get clout and a sense of belonging, and like, the world makes sense. I think a lot of what we do is we are finite creatures surrounded by infinite complexity. Of course you're going to be terrified. Of course you're going to look for the new God, whatever the God is, whether the God is in biohacking and longevity so that you feel like you're not going to die, whether it's in productivity and learning how to get more done in less time so that it feels like you can actually control the way that your day looks, whether it's in a political ideology that gives you the answers that makes you feel like you're with a group of people that is on a righteous cause. Dude, people need to have independent thought. How do you cultivate independent thought? I don't know. That is far too much. It's far too difficult of a question for me. How do you get rid of group ideologies and not believe in the madness of crowds? It's almost impossible. It's almost impossible to try and come up with a way. But I know that individuals can, because it sounds like you are, and I know that I am, and I'm constantly surrounded. People try and embroil me in left versus right discussions all the time, right? Because I have Rutger Bregman on, who is the guy that called out all of the billionaires at the Davos conference, super, super lefty, wants universal basic income. But then I'll have a Douglas Murray or a Sargon of Akkad who ran for UKIP down in the south of the UK. And I can have a conversation with both of these people because I think that there's truth that comes from both of them.
Yeah.
Not being attached to your viewpoints, and not having a fear of being proven wrong, and not having not clutching onto the desire to be proven right. I think those are some immediate cognitive biases that can cause people to not ever want to think for themselves, because if a particular ideology can come to them and say, well, look, here it is, we got it all in this nice, neat little package. If you just believe all of this stuff, you don't ever have to think for yourself. And that causes people to never question. Whereas if you're just constantly like, well, let me stress test this. Let me see if this actually does work. And then if it doesn't, then fine. Here's something interesting, man, that I realized when I spoke to Konstantin Kissin from Trigonometry. I spoke to him, and he classes himself as a Chad centrist, whatever that is. And I realized that in 2021, the highest price is paid by the people in the middle. Because if you're far left or far right, you can at least be assured of getting agreement from one side. Whereas when you're in the middle, you guarantee disagreement from both.
This is so true. this is our ultimate dilemma. If I put out a news article that flippin' says, you know, You know, Boris Johnson's, you know, a bit done some bad stuff and some good stuff. People are like, go away.
Well, that's one perfect way to ensure that everybody's going to hate you. Because at the moment on the internet, everybody's getting pushed out and out. And this is again why we should all be very skeptical of anybody who you hear one or two things that they say and you can predict everything else that they say, right? Like, it should be the case that your view on abortion is only very slightly linked to your view of how we should interact with global markets. And that should only be very slightly linked to how you see that we should have an immigration policy. And that should only be very slightly linked to your thoughts on the First Amendment and on the Second Amendment. But all of these things get bundled together into one sort of...
That's a very good way to put it. Case in point, the Meghan Markle interview with Oprah. So interesting to me because, you know, watched it. I'm not going to talk much about that, could discuss that at length. But it interested me because, like, a right-wing kind of American person who I know does not care about the story at all then tweets out, oh, the woke left, Meghan Markle has... I was like, what? It was such a far-field comment to somehow take this issue and spin it into, you know, trigger words and, you know, keywords like woke. But also, how is this a left-wing issue?
I just kind of... how is it a politicized issue at all?
This is one woman talking about her experience.
So this is here's one of the problems. The problem is now that because political parties are trying to find whatever ammunition they can to throw the mudslinging to go at the other side, politics now is very unpolitical. It's actually about everything that isn't to do with politics a lot of the time. So it very much is to do with these pop culture, these sort of milestone pop culture moments that we come up against, like the Meghan Markle thing. And what political parties are trying to do is attach themselves to a type of thinking, a mode of thinking, a type of person, and they then adopt them as an ambassador. So, for instance, here's actually, I've wanted to do this for ages, and you might be the man for it, right? How can we characterize the current cultural brand values of the left and the right? I'll go first. So the left, I think they're trying to put across compassion, understanding, openness, nuanced thought, like that we understand things that are a little bit more complex than maybe everybody else does. And then if you were to go for the right, it would be rationality, it would be traditional values, it would be a counter to the madness and the loss of tradition and understanding of what actually happens. Do you understand sort of where I'm trying to go with this? Do you understand what I'm trying to put across? What are your thoughts? How would you characterize the brand values?
Very, very difficult. It's such a great
Think compassion's right. I definitely think the left is playing on compassion now.
Well, I would question whether it's genuine compassion
that's what they're portraying.
Or whether the compassion's being used as a tool almost. And I'm not saying that to say, you know, anything untoward. I couldn't hand on my heart say the left compassion. I wouldn't say that.
I know, but that's performatively. This is performatively. Yeah. What are they trying to do?
What I would say is, I think the left is interested in structural change by any means necessary. That's how I would characterize it. I think the left right now, the interest of structural change and whatever is going to help get there, it's like, you know, we've played nice for long enough. Whatever it is, we're going to use any story.
And that's why I was seeing the adoption of the slightly more right-wing tactics. Yes. Okay, what about the right?
And I think right now, if I think about right-wing thought, it's interesting because I can see... It's probably more defensive, I think. I haven't really seen advocated any kind of right wing ideals. And it's funny because you speak about Douglas Murray, his book, something about the crowds? Madness of Crowds. You know, it speaks a bit to this. Like, I think the right wing has lost its kind of what it's advocating for. And so a lot of right wing thought, commentary, ideas seem very defensive. and almost as though it's reactive to that left wing pull to say, let's shake the system up, so to speak. That's how I think, if I'm being honest,
that is characterized both very parties. That's very insightful. I think you're totally correct. So it feels a little bit like the left wing, because they are galvanizing whatever they can get in order to create structural change. Is it racism? Is it something to do with your genitals? Is it something to do with what genitals you like? Is it something to do with et cetera, roll it forward, roll it forward. And these are just all bullets that are being shot into the side of the ship that the right wing are sat in. And all that the right wing are doing is running around desperately with corks, plugging these different holes, just trying to stop all of this water coming on board. There's this quote, man, I don't know where it came from. I'd love someone to tell me, because Naval said it on a Joe Rogan episode, and he said, the left won the culture war. Now they're just driving around shooting the survivors.
That's brilliant.
So good. And if that's not... Dude, think about the Oscars. Think about the signaling that we have that's going on. And like, inevitably, you are right, actually, that it doesn't ever permit the right to make steps forward. The only way that the right wins at the moment is like a counter-defensive boxer.
Yeah.
If we'd seen a Trump victory in 2020, I think you would have had pretty good cause to say that the counter-defensive up against the madness of the left is absolutely the strategy to go down after you had 2019 in the UK general election, landslide, like, what, biggest distance in 30, 40 years, something like that.
Yeah.
But because we didn't have that, that's added some more nuance and complexity into the situation. Obviously, Project Veritas and what James O'Keefe's doing is potentially opening up some more nefarious insights into just how that could have occurred. I'm going to be so interested to see how that plays out. But yes, it's definitely that. It's definitely structural change by any means and counter defense.
Yeah.
Just our benefit, or our value as the right, is what they would say, is not being that. And what, listen to Ben Shapiro, listen to Matt Walsh, listen to Gavin McGinnis, listen to any of those guys, what they're talking about at the moment. Very rarely are they ever actually talking about their own stuff.
Yeah.
All of the stories from the left come from the left, but all of the stories for the right come from the left as well.
Absolutely. And it's reactions. And it's, as you said, it's Ben Shapiro destroying or correcting people. Which kind of go, but what do you have to say? As in, what do you advocate, and what should society be structured as? And it's like, oh, doesn't matter. The left are ruining things. You know, the left are advocating this is bad for our children. But at some stage, one has to advocate, you know, what should things be then, and how, and to make it attractive, you know, to kind of, you know, to do what you had a few years ago with Christian conservatism, where you had a couple of folks who, they call them young, restless, and reformed, who took, you know, Christianity, which was typically kind of, you know, old and whatever, and they made it really cool. You know, they made it interesting, and they were advocating for what they thought the world should be like. You've given up so much time, Chris. I want to make sure I ask this question, which is, I mean, we've talked about a number of things today. Amazing stuff that I think folks listening will appreciate. How did you speak about this on Love Island? I've never watched it, but I just I'm obviously missing out, because if there's conversations like this happening,
I can promise you that I was not talking about this on Love Island. No. So it was, like I say, this was kind of goes back to what we said at the start, but I was playing this meta role. I was this guy who was a club promoter, big name on campus, and I went in playing that role. So I was watching myself perform, right, as I was this lad and doing this sort of stuff. But every so often I'd slip up. And the weird thing is that there's someone listening to your microphone 24 hours a day, even when you're asleep. So there was just three people on each person, and they'd do 8-hour shifts, 8 hours, 8 hours, 8 hours, 8 hours, 8 hours, 8 hours. That was it. Wow. Each day. So there would be three people that knew every word you'd said for the last month. And I came out, and one of the guys came up to me in the canteen as I was doing my exit interviews, and this is where all of the production team were. One of the guys came up and they went, "Hey man, I just wanted to say hello. Like, I'm John or whatever, and this is Dave. And basically, we've listened to everything that you've said for the last 3 weeks. And I wanted to ask about, you know, The Science of Interstellar, written by Kip Thorne, the consultant physicist on the Interstellar Chris Nolan movie that you talked about. Would you just be?" And I was like, oh God, I slipped up at some point, and it's when I thought the cameras were off, but these bastards were still listening to me. So the lesson to take from it, man, is if you hide who you truly are for too long, you can bury yourself under so many personas that you don't know who you are anymore. And the job to dig that back out is something that you can do. So if there's someone listening that goes, oh God, that's so me. I work in an environment with people who all love football and booze, or who are all super lefty and always want to talk about politics, or who are all super academic and just never want to really have fun or whatever it might be. And you have had to play a role for so long. It is possible to dig yourself back out of that, to do the self-inquiry, to work out, okay, so what's my truth? What do I believe in? What do I want? What's the sort of person I want to be? It is possible to do that. And it's the least easy to see transformation that you're ever going to see, right? Like, it's got nothing to do with the way that you look on the outside. It doesn't massively even manifest in how you hold yourself. But God, if it doesn't make a change to the internal texture of your mind, and it's so much more of a happy place to be, because all that I need to do when I have this conversation with you is think what's in my head. I don't need to think what the person that I'm supposed to be is supposed to say.
Yeah.
That's exhausting and terrifying. And it didn't work very well on Love Island. So don't do it.
Chris, you are a hero, man. Honestly, like this, I think this, I'm so glad this was recorded. Like, I'm kind of like, this is just such great stuff for someone who's listening. So folks, if this has helped you in any way, like, you've got to share this stuff. This is really, really good stuff. And honestly, more power to you. I'm so glad you're doing this and not modeling. Not that modeling isn't good, but I'm sure you maybe model on the side as well or something, right? But I'm just so glad that the sum total of Chris isn't like a kind of Love Island, you know, influencer, so to speak, but it's that that we get to see your mind and listen to your mind, because it genuinely is beautiful, man. This was powerful stuff. And I really enjoyed it, dude.
I really, really enjoyed it. We should do this again.
I hope so. This was brilliant. So folks, if you enjoy this, you know, hit this, how is it? I'm really bad at the promo part. Hit the subscribe button and and share it with somebody. But I really hope this helped you. And Chris, thank you so much for being a part of this.
Mike, brother, thank you for having me.